Welcome back
to the second hour of today's edition of Truth Behead Radio, right here on We the People Radio Network. I'm Kevin Barrett. I try to bring on the most interesting guests that you'll ever find anywhere, and we certainly have one of those today, Elias Davidson, leading European 9/11 and human rights activist and researcher. Tomorrow, I'll be bringing on Wisconsin's best-loved libertarian politician, probably Wisconsin's best-loved politician, period, Ed Thompson. He's the good brother of Tommy Thompson, the former Bush administration ATW chief and governor of Wisconsin. Ed is a terrific guy. He's one of the most spiritual people I know. He's always got some really some nuggets of wisdom to share, so it'll be great to have him on. Then Dale Decker of the Union Down movement, the people who are flying the U.S. flag upside down as a signal of distress. That'll be on tomorrow. Then on my other shows, well, to find those, just go to barrettforcongress.us, and they will show up. Okay, getting back to the conversation with Elias Davidson. Elias, he suggested that you want to get some questions, but I need to ask you questions about something that you information that you know well and want to share. So what are some topics that you want to be questioned on?
Well, basically, what I'm concerned with is to get the message to listeners that they should stand up each time that anybody is mentioning 9/11 together with the word Muslim. They should not just argue that this is wrong. They should denounce this kind of accusations as defamation.
Absolutely.
For the reason, because those who are accusing Muslims for 9/11 don't have any evidence to support such accusations. So what I suggest, and I did it before already, is that the 9/11 truthers should go to the offensive and actually denounce and accuse anybody who dares to accuse Muslims for this kind of crime, not just to discuss with them, but to accuse them straight away, to charge them for defamation.
Well, that's a terrific idea. I actually have had the same thought. That's why I stood up and interrupted a talk by Daniel Pipe, the notorious Islamophobic bigot, who was doing a thing called, was it Islamic Extremism Awareness Week or something like that? Islamofascism Awareness Week, that's what it was. He was touring campuses giving this kind of hate speech. And so when I went to see him, you know, I waited until he brought up the 9/11 blood libel, and then I stood up and interrupted him, and it created a bit of a disturbance. I did manage to escape without being arrested. But And that's why I did it. I agree. Every time somebody brings this up, every time somebody says that Muslims did 9/11, I immediately am always going to stand up and challenge them on that. And I think students should do this in college classrooms. If a professor, says something that seems to accept that interpretation of the war on terror and that Muslim responsibility for 9/11, stand up and challenge the professor and say, well, where's your evidence for this?
Basically, I think that it should not be asking where the evidence. I think that the people who are making these charges should be challenged more forcefully by being basically denounced as defamators, as slanderers, because anybody who is making this accusation has never seen any evidence whatsoever to support that accusation.
Well, that's a good point. And they will try to, they'll bring up the so-called evidence that they think they remember from reading about in the newspapers, the alleged cell phone calls from 35,000 feet and things like that.
There is not one single court decision which was basically confirming that Muslims boarded these planes. In criminal law, you cannot just rely on what the government is saying or the prosecutor. You have to rely on a finding by the independent body. And there is no finding like that.
There certainly isn't, because as you've said so eloquently, there just isn't any evidence that these guys were on the plane.
Now, there is not only that. There is not even evidence that any passengers boarded those planes. We don't know where the passengers went when they went to the airport. We do not know whether they went on a plane And if so, on which plane? Because there is no testimony of anybody who saw the boarding process. And not a single testimony.
Yet one would think that there would be such testimony. After all, you would think the media would want to find the people who boarded these planes.
Well, the media has never asked to interview the people who witnessed the boarding. So the media were, in fact, complicit in this act by not demanding to see the people and to talk to the people who actually witnessed the boarding process. And the media are quite aware of that, why they did not ask for that evidence, because this evidence does not exist.
Well, that's pretty stunning that the media media bosses are really aware of this. That makes them accessories to high treason and mass murder.
Yes, I believe so. I say it publicly, and I'm not at all shy of saying that the media, those who are running the media, the main media in the U.S. and the world, are basically complicit in covering up the crime. There is no question in my mind about it. They are part of the criminal gang. Now, the question is how to reach these people. I don't know. That's another question.
Right.
I would like to also, there is another issue which I just like to mention, is that in Europe there is now a very great movement for 9/11 truth, especially in France, in Britain, and in Holland. Now they are starting in Germany and in the Netherlands and in the Nordic countries. So there is a movement of people who are very interested in revealing the truth. In France, it is the same like in the United States, that anybody who publicly tries to ask questions or even suspect that something is fishy with 9/11 is prone to lose his job. A few journalists already lost their jobs in the French national radio because
really?
They dare to ask questions.
I didn't know that. Can you send me information about that?
Yes, of course, I could do that. The thing is that 9/11 is the cement of governments today to keep in power. And revealing 9/11, the truth of it, is a danger not only to the U.S. elite, but to the elite of practically all countries. Because every government is basically happy to have tools called the war on terror in order to demonize their own dissidents. Therefore, you have a cooperation between the intelligence agencies of Algeria, Turkey, Israel, Egypt, United States, Britain, and all these countries are cooperating in order to demonize their own dissidents in the name of the war on terror. And this is the reason why the United Nations have agreed to jump on the wagon of the war on terror, in spite of the fact that there is not a single evidence that the international terrorism is a threat.
Right. That's really interesting. It makes me think about the way that governments never seem to want to expose the other government's false flag attacks, perhaps because false flag attacks are such powerful tools for people in charge of government that they don't want to reveal the trick.
I would like to mention one particular fact which probably was not mentioned yet publicly. I wrote a letter to the Counterterrorism Committee of the Security Council of the United Nations asking for statistics about mortality from terrorism. The reason why I wrote to them is that the Security Council has designated terrorism as one of the gravest dangers, the gravest threats to international peace and security. So I wanted to know on which empirical evidence the Security Council is basing its determination. So I wrote to the Counterterrorism Committee of the Security Council, asked for the statistics, and the reply was, we don't have any such statistics.
Right. So it's just the idea of terrorism that is so terribly dangerous, not the reality.
Well, when the Security Council determines that terrorism is such a threat and they don't even have figures, to able to substantiate that threat. This shows that they are not serious, that they know quite well that they are lying, that they are deceiving the people, they're defrauding everybody. And we are talking here about the Security Council of the United Nations, which is supposed to represent humankind and all the countries of the world.
Well, I guess if you actually did collect statistics on how many people are injured or killed in terrorist attacks, you would find that probably fewer than die drowning in their bathtubs or be struck by lightning. Actually, that, we did find that. We just looked at a terrorist attack here in the U.S., and you get fewer than 3,000 deaths in a century, most of them occurring on 9/11. And that number adds up. It's a lot of people to die horribly in one day. But if you look at it by comparison with other causes of death, that adds up to fewer than 2 days' worth of cigarette fatalities in the USA, or 29 days' worth of automobile fatalities. So,
according to my own research, the funding for anti-terrorist, the funding by the U.S. government to fight terrorism was already $8 billion a year at the time where about one or two people in the U.S. died from terrorism a year. So we have already that kind of figures, $8 billion to fight a danger which kills one or two people a year.
That's right. Yeah, it's a gigantic hoax is what it is. And it's amazing that even, the people who believe the official story of 9/11 should be able to process these kinds of facts and figures and understand that despite this spectacular public relations stunt that they witnessed on television, the reality is that this just is not a real danger.
No, not at all. In fact, the danger is the war on terror is the danger.
That's right. Another way of thinking about it, though, Elias, is that if terrorism is political violence, or let's say political violence aimed at civilians, then virtually all terrorism is conducted by governments, because governments are those very entities which define themselves as being the group that has the monopoly on violence in a given territory. And governments do use their monopoly on violence to cause the deaths and injuries of great numbers of people. So political violence, most of it is war, and virtually all of it is being conducted by governments. Therefore, the only terrorists that really matter on Earth are governments.
Yeah, I agree, fully agree. We're talking about government terrorism, I would like to add that terrorism in international law is basically a very minor kind of offense. It doesn't amount to the other offenses under international law, like war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. Basically, those are the real big crimes. Terrorism has not been considered such a big crime under international law. If you look, for instance, at the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, you don't find terrorism as one of the basic crimes, because it is considered completely trivial as a crime.
Right. But in terms of its public relations impact since 9/11, it's been the ultimate satanic figure of evil that everybody has to unite against. It's almost like we're living in a comic book world.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know if we can still have another go, because I would like to comment upon that, or you would like to wait for...
Well, sure. You can go ahead. We have probably a minute or two before the next break, and then we'll have plenty of time after.
Well, probably I will do it after the break.
Okay. Yeah. Sometimes it's easiest to try to keep an unbroken block of time.
Yes, because you see the reason is that basically there is one question of defining terrorism, one problem of defining which I did not note that anybody has in fact discovered that kind of angle. I'd like to come back on that later.
Okay, yeah, that's a great point. I'm actually working on a book project that does involve, questions of defining terrorism. And maybe our listeners can try and come up with a definition of terrorism, too, if they want to join in. We are here at We the People Radio Network. The call-in number is area code 512-646-1984. That's 512-646-1984. What do you think terrorism is? What's a good definition of terrorism? Is it, as I said, political violence, especially the kind that targets civilians? And if so, is it not the world's military forces that do most of this? You know, every war since the American Civil War has increasingly tended to target civilians. Sherman marched through Georgia and burned down civilian property in the American Civil War. And since then, we've seen things like the attacks on civilian populations in World War II, where the Germans bombed British cities and the British and then Americans firebombed German cities and Japanese cities and dropped nuclear weapons on Japanese cities, all of this targeting civilians. Warfare, counterinsurgency warfare, which is the main kind of warfare the U.S. has conducted since World War II, targets civilians. Vietnam was all about targeting civilians. Iraq is right now all about targeting civilians because the civilian population is resisting occupation, of course. So what is terrorism anyway? Feel free to call on in and tell us, and Elias Davidson will have some thoughts on that when we come back after the break. Once again, that number is 512-646-1984.
You're listening to We the People Radio Network. Pure energy. We the People Radio Network.
Welcome back. This is the Truth Jihad Radio Show. I'm your host, Kevin Barrett, coming on here every Saturday and Sunday, 2 to 4 p.m. Central Time, right here on We the People Radio Network. I'm talking with Elias Davidson. And Elias, should we bring on the callers first, or did you want to talk about terrorism first yourself?
Well, if you have a caller there.
Okay, let's let the callers try first. Okay, Mark from Houston is on. Hello, Mark. Come on in.
Hello, Kevin. It's Mark. Are you reading me okay?
We read you loud and clear, Mark. How's it going?
Hey, Kevin, I just wanted to talk to some other people today that are not locked within the matrix, and I'm grateful that you're there. It occurs to me that with the bailout fiasco and that the people are starting to wake up and the iron is hot for 9/11 truth, but what I wanted to ask you about, I'm not real sure what to do about that, but what I wanted to ask you about was the AIG connection to 9/11. Weren't they one of the major insurers?
You know, I understand there is some such connection, but I don't know a whole lot about that aspect of things. Well, wasn't Hank Greenberg one of the people involved with that?
Right, there you go.
Yeah.
There you go. There's always those key names, the big players. I did get a Wikipedia definition of terrorism, and I can give you that, but there's the Wikipedia rundown on the Clarion Fund is truly interesting, and it seems as though that the my Jewish people, my father's side of the family is Jewish, and I know there's a lot of love in Jewish families, but they just keep coming up. They're always connected. They're always connected to the big money, the big power, and so, you know, you got to follow the trail where it leads, and it leads to AIG. And, oh, I guess I don't really have my thoughts all together that good, but I'll tell you, it's really hard being out of the matrix and seeing what's coming down. And I'm really scared about the financial situation, because I want to make one more statement. And after everything I've studied about this, that what, in my opinion, what 9/11 was a statement by the big money, the big power, that we are totally ruthless, and we will do anything to control you. It's like a big poker game to them. And that's just my opinion. 9/11 is a statement, and I don't know. We can just take it from there.
Yeah, I'm sure it definitely was, among other things. Did you want to try to define terrorism? Well, you don't need to give us a Wikipedia definition, but if you had some thoughts yourself, that would be okay.
Well, what Bush and company and the power structure is doing is certainly terrorism. You know, you got to understand the power structure. There's a huge power structure that's interconnected on this whole thing, and it has been for quite some time throughout history. I mean, we know about that, but the average person doesn't know about that, and they refuse to be educated. But when you hit them in the pocketbook like they're doing now, that was another all-out threat, this financial thing. So they'll threaten you anyway, and this is what's going on, and I don't know what to do about it. I'm thinking about taking all my funds and putting them into foreign currencies. But so I don't, like I said, I'm not real together on my thoughts, but you guys can maybe get something out of that. And the man you have on is real good, and his idea about putting this database together and putting these people on notice is a real good idea. Again, that's about all I have. Again, thank you guys.
Okay, well, thanks for your thoughts, Mark. Appreciate it.
Okay, bye.
Thank you.
Well, I think Mark was sort of, you know, in saying that the Bush regime is a bunch of terrorists, he's right in that another way of thinking about terrorism is that it involves using fear to manipulate people. And who's done that more than the Bush regime? So what are your thoughts, Elias?
Well, of course, yeah. Now, what I would like to bring into the discussion about terrorism, because there has been for years the United Nations has been trying to grope with the definition, and many people have been. Basically, the problem is that the criminal law has been it was very difficult to define terrorism because it's a very subjective kind of definition it requires. Now, in criminal law, you have, for instance, homicide, killing people is a kind of murder. And okay, if somebody puts a bomb and kills individuals, he would be accused of killing, of murder. So criminal law can address all these things. Now, what people say is the terrorist not only wants to kill somebody, but he wants to kill in order to create fear. Now, here is where I am coming into the discussion, and I say the following. Now, listen carefully. If we examine terrorism, how terrorism is accomplished, we find that the execution of the crime consists of two distinct phases. The first phase is the act itself, like killing, putting a bomb, and so on. But this act itself doesn't create fear, because if you are on the next street where the bomb is, you might not even hear the bomb. You wouldn't know about the crime. So you cannot fear something which you don't know. So the second phase of a terrorist act is to terrorize the population. But the typical terrorist, he cannot terrorize the population because he doesn't control the media. So it is the media which are controlling the flow of information, and it is the media who, by reporting the terrorist act, is in fact ensuring that the terrorist is accomplishing his goal. So in every terrorist act, there are two actors. It is the one who is putting the bomb, who is doing the killing, and the other actor are the media, who are frightening the population by highly reporting this incident. So terrorism cannot be thought out. You cannot think of terrorism except as a symbiotic act between some criminal and mass media.
And that's a good point. And in terms of who actually is creating most of the fear, it's not the criminal, it's the media.
Well, basically, suppose that I would now go and put a bomb somewhere in an office or in the market here in Bonn, where I'm living. How would you know about it? You would not fear. People in Germany would not fear. People in Bonn who are not at the marketplace would hardly know about it unless they are reading in the papers.
And then whoever controls the paper can decide whether to put it in streaming headlines on page 1 or at the bottom of page 14.
Exactly. So when, for instance, there is a mass strike where 100,000 people are striking, not going to work, and the papers decide not to publish the news. Why? Because that's their own agenda. Now, instead of when thousands of people or hundreds of or millions of people are demonstrating or striking, the media decide, well, we don't want to publish it. But if one guy puts a bomb somewhere, they're going to put it on headlines. Why? Because it's their own agenda. They want to create that fear. They have the motive to do it. And they are participating completely in the terrorist act. So basically, if anybody should be brought to court for terrorism, it is first of all one, the person who put the bomb, and secondly, those who are publicizing the act.
Well, that's a great point. And you know, along with going after these media people for defamation, as we discussed earlier, in blaming Muslims for 9/11, despite the fact there's no evidence whatsoever for any Muslim involvement in 9/11, maybe we should go after the media for this kind of terrorism as well, because simply by promoting this notion that, for instance, 9/11 was such a huge threatening thing, when in fact, the number of people killed in the U.S. by terrorism in a whole century is about the same number that die every 2 days from cigarettes, they are terrorizing us.
Well, I would personally not choose to take 9/11 for that
okay,
purpose.
Well, we'll have to pick that up after the break. We're going into another break, but we'll be right back.
Okay.
All right. This is Kevin Barrett with Elias Davidson. Stay tuned.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
This is Kevin Barrett. You're listening to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm talking today with Elias Davidson, the Icelandic 9/11 truth activist, now resident in Germany, a leading 9/11 truth researcher, activist, and human rights activist in general. We're talking about how the media is an integral part of, perhaps the most important part of, any act of terrorism, because to terrorize the population, it's the media that has to spread the message. We have a couple of callers on the line. Elias, did you want to get to something before we bring on the callers?
No.
Okay, well, let's go straight to the callers. First, it's Harlan from Texas. Hello, Harlan. Is this Harlan from Brave New Books, by any chance? Hello, Harlan.
No. I'm an author in San Antonio, and thankfully I'm able to pick up your show on my radio. I really wanted to thank you guys, and really tell you that you're really performing a great public service, and I think your guest in Germany is just wonderful. I wanted to ask. I'm sorry. Can you still hear me?
Yeah. You're coming through.
My phone was beeping. I wanted to just throw something out there. I had a good friend of mine who recently passed. He was a officer in Hitler's army, unwilling participant. He was drafted, but he spent, years in the war, 3 years in a Russian prison camp after the war, finally immigrated over here, and essentially we would have long talks and basically talking about just war, 9/11, everything, and it just boiled down for him at the end of the day, at the end of his life. He would just tell me, war is nothing more than a license to commit mass murder. And I just always remember that. Any war movie I saw after he said that, any political conversation, it just seemed to ring true. And I was kind of thinking, since terrorism is, to a certain extent, it is different than an actual, all-out war. I was sort of wondering, I wanted to ask your guest if he would maybe think that terrorism is perhaps mass murder without the official sanction.
Well, if you ask me, well, first of all, I would like to thank you for your very nice appreciation. I'm very flattered. About the terrorism and war, basically, I can just quote a cousin of mine who lives in Israel. He lives in Jerusalem. And he said, when I asked him, how is it to live in Jerusalem when there is so much terrorism? And he just laughed. He said, terrorism is no problem. We get used to it like to road accidents. It happens here and there, and some people die. But war is completely something different. It is an attack on a whole nation. It is like the difference between being pinned by hurt by one nail on the foot, or being attacked completely by being burned, 70 or 80% of the body to being burned. There is a difference, a huge difference between war and terror. Terror is basically one crime at one place and one time. And war is an attack upon the whole society. So please don't mix the two things together. And I think this is important to keep the, even if a terrorism attack leads to the death of 3,000 people, it is basically a mass murder. It is the word terrorism, I think, is completely overused and possibly should not be used at all. Because I think criminal law can address all these forms of attacks. Domestically, all killings are just murder. And internationally, we have war crimes, we have crimes against humanity, and we have genocide, which are covering all the attacks which have been happening in Iraq, Afghanistan. So we don't need a new terminology like terrorism.
Right, absolutely.
Okay, That answers your question, okay, Harlan?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, thank you very much for taking my call.
Well, thank you for calling in. Appreciate it.
Okay,
sure.
Bye.
Bye-bye. All right.
Yeah,
my first thought was that might be the Harlan that I know who lives in Texas. He works at the Brave New Bookstore in Austin, which is probably my favorite bookstore in the country. I wish it was closer to me. So anyway, there's a little shout-out to the other Harlan. Well, now I have two favorite Harlans in Texas. Yeah, no, I think that's an interesting point, Elias, that that war is a vastly greater crime than terrorism.
Let me mention, because what I'm saying may be sound subjective, my view, let's see. Well, I'd like to quote, I think, if it was correct, if it was Jackson or some other person who was presiding over the Nuremberg trial in 1945, and I think he or some other of the judges at Nuremberg said that a war of aggression, it means the initiation of a war of an aggressive war, is the supreme crime in which all other crimes are subsumed. So basically, war is one of the biggest crimes against humanity which exists, and therefore aggressive war is considered a crime under international law and under the statute of the International Criminal Court. So what the United States has done in Afghanistan and in Iraq is aggressive war, which is a crime under international law, which raises both state responsibility of the United States towards the aggressed countries, and it raises also the individual criminal liability of those who initiated that war. So basically we have here both illegality and criminality. Within the framework of war, of the aggressive war, we have then the possibility of committing war crimes, like attacking civilians, torturing, and so forth.
Well, that's a very good point. And here in the U.S., it's hard to get this through to people. Most of the discourse here is about how the Iraq war was a mistake, and most of the talk about the destruction from the war is about the 2,000 U.S. Troops who've died there, and the destruction to the U.S. economy, rather than to the million people dead in Iraq, and the fact that this was a criminal war of aggression. But there are a few people that are waking up to this fact that it really was a criminal war of aggression. Yet, many of those people don't understand that the same thing is true of the war in Afghanistan. They have this notion that because they still believe the official story of 9/11, They imagine that somehow bin Laden was linked to the Taliban, and therefore that those guys attacked us. So it was not a war of aggression to go into Afghanistan. What's your position on that?
May I comment upon that?
Sure.
Well, the war in Afghanistan is doubly illegal. First of all, and let us first of all assume that the official account on 9/11 would be true, that Osama bin Laden or some people in Afghanistan were actually responsible for 9/11. Even in that case, an attack on Afghanistan 1 month after would be illegal under international law, because self-defense, which was basically invoked by the United States government in its letter to the Security Council, self-defense is only invocable in extremis. It means when there is an army invading the United States or attacking the United States, or if there is an imminent attack by another state on the United States. So basically, as you can look in every textbook of international law, invoking self-defense is only permitted in the most extreme situations where there is absolutely no other resort except the use of force. Now, when the United States, after the 9/11, on the 12th of September, there was nothing happening in the United States, from that day on, there was no right of self-defense. The United States had to go to the Security Council of the United Nations and say, we would like now the Security Council to adopt a resolution of inquiry or investigating the attacks and eventually arresting those who were the perpetrators. But the United States, of course, did not want to do that. They wanted just to invoke self-defense. And what is the saddest thing about it is the Security Council somehow agreed or acquiesced to this kind of definition of self-defense. And this is, of course, showed that the Security Council cannot be relied to stop aggression.
Certainly can't, at least not in that circumstance. Probably the anthrax attacks contributed to this notion, too, even though we now know those were an inside job. We'll be back in a moment. Kevin Durrett with Elias Davidson right here on Proof Behead Radio. Stick around.
Great host, great topics, free speech at its best. This is We the People Radio Network.
Welcome back. Final segment of today's edition of Truth Jihad Radio, right here at We the People Radio Network. Talking with one of my favorite 9/11 truth activists and researchers, Elias Davidson, of the European 9/11 Truth Movement, and his website, which we haven't mentioned before, and we better go ahead and do that, is, we'll spell it out, it's juicecogens.org. We'll spell that out for you, JUSCOGENS.org. That's JUSCOGENS.org. Well, Elias, we do have another caller. Should we go ahead and bring the caller up? Or?
Sure, sure.
Okay, next caller is Carl from Montreal. Hey, Carl, how's it going? Hello, Carl. Hello, Carl. Come in, Carl. Well, we're maybe having a technical difficulty, or maybe Carl wasn't able to stay on the line there. Carl? Hello? All right. No luck there with Carl. So I guess we were talking about the illegality of the invasion of Afghanistan, which clearly was not in the heat of self-defense. And, in fact, I think that one of the reasons for the false flag anthrax attack, which was a follow-up, or maybe part of the 9/11 operation, was to give this impression that radical Muslim extremists were going to be continuing these murderous terror attacks on the U.S., that we were we're going to be in a permanent state of war where this would be happening every couple of weeks for who knows how long. And that created the climate of fear that led people to acquiesce in this attacking Afghanistan under the impression that the people who were doing this sort of thing were in Afghanistan. Well, now we know not only that there's no evidence against any of these 19 guys or bin Laden himself for 9/11, but even the government is claiming that the anthrax attacks were perpetrated by an American germ warfare scientist, Dr. Bruce Ivins. He's actually probably innocent. It was probably a different group of American germ warfare scientists working with the CIA that did it. But in either case, the U.S. government admits that it was a false flag attack designed to blame Muslims. Envelopes full of anthrax what did they write on those? Death to America, death to Israel. Lie is great.
Yes, and by the way, I don't know if you're aware of that on the 12th of September, in the morning of 12th of September, Ari Fleischer had a press conference in which he announced that the attacks are over.
He did?
Yes.
How did he know that?
Well, he said that they are, according to intelligence reports, the terrorists had already done their attacks and the threat is now receded.
And then they went ahead and hit us with the anthrax attack.
That he said in the press conference.
Right, right.
So that means that he basically had information knowing exactly what the plans of the so-called terrorists were. And the thing is that this kind of response was reported in the papers, but then the transcript of the press conference was removed from the website of the White House. Because this was extremely embarrassing.
Well, yeah, that's pretty incriminating. How would he know the attacks are over unless he's part of the group that's conducting them?
Exactly. So I discovered that they removed this transcript from the website of the White House. But I have this transcript.
Well, are they up on your website?
Yes, it is up there. It is up there.
Okay, again, that is juscogens.org. An excellent site.
Well, there is a lot of this kind of information. You will find that there are all kinds of things which have been appearing at that time, shortly after 9/11, and then they were removed. You know.
Right. Yeah. There are some other items like that.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting field for people to go back and try to dig through all of the original reports. And all these things keep turning up, like all of these premature reports of the demise of Building 7. It wasn't just the BBC, but CNN and other networks before that were reporting the demise of Building 7 before it happened.
Another thing which I'd like to mention, which is quite interesting, I think most people don't know, that we have always heard, we always believed that the U.S. government has accused Osama bin Laden for the crime. However, if you look for statements by George Bush or by Rumsfeld or by Cheney accusing Osama bin Laden for 9/11, you won't find such statements.
Well, I think Bush has said things like there was one press conference when he was asked about when he was going to be providing the evidence against bin Laden that he had promised. He responded that, well, we don't need to because we know he's guilty.
Well, I don't remember that, but
that was in the fall of 2001.
Yes, but in any case, I really looked hard for any statements of accusations, and the only one I found is basically one statement by Colin Powell. Very funny, but one statement by him where he basically accused Osama bin Laden. But I did not find any statements by the vice president or by the president or by Rumsfeld explicitly accusing Osama bin Laden.
Interesting. Well, Colin Powell had announced that they were going to be presenting a white paper that would outline the evidence of bin Laden's guilt. And he made that announcement fairly shortly after 9/11. And then they never produced the white paper, and when journalists asked Bush about that, he said, oh, we don't need any evidence. We know he's guilty.
Yes, I understand. I see. Well, the same thing applies to this guy, to this clown there who is in Guantanamo, who nobody knows really who he is, he's designated as the mastermind of 9/11. It's really one joke.
That's right. Yeah, evidence about his career as a terrorist is pretty interesting. As you said in your letter, he apparently is, you know, he's one of these high-living, you know, hard-drinking, you know, pseudo-Muslims who, you know, he's a womanizer, you know, just kind of like some of these 19 guys that they blame for 9/11. He lived the life more of an intelligence agent than a fanatical Muslim. And he's also, an interesting thing about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is that if you look back in the 9/11 terror timeline, you'll see that when he was supposedly arrested in Pakistan, the Pakistani authorities, with the help of the U.S. authorities, put out a video that supposedly showed him being arrested in the raid on his house. But this video was so laughably, hilariously bogus, it was so obviously a really clumsily made, terrible reenactment of this arrest, that the room full of journalists collapsed in laughter.
Yeah, I believe you. Well, you see, this guy, you see, no, really, we don't know who the guy is in Guantanamo who is presented in the papers as Khalid Mohammed Sheikh. We don't know whether it is this guy or somebody else or whether it is just fabricated evidence. We have no idea because nobody has seen that guy since, I don't know, years ago. And right. And if we look at the transcript of the first so-called confession which he made there, we find that this guy purports to be a very religious Muslim, which this Khalid Sheikh was not. Also, he uses very bad Arabic, and according to the Wikipedia, the real one has got an engineering degree from University of Carolina, North Carolina.
He's English. He has bad English.
Yeah, very bad English.
Right. Yeah, that is pretty strange. He has an engineering degree from an American university, and yet he can hardly speak English.
It doesn't work. Something doesn't add up. So basically, you see, and the thing is, the U.S. government has been very, very careful not to show this guy to anybody outside the court. So nobody has no journalist and no human rights worker and nobody in the press has seen the guy who we are told is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
Even the 9/11 commission never saw him.
No. And this is really, you know, this shows at what abyss, at what depth our newspapers have gone to present these kind of facts as if they were facts. We are talking about really a situation which has never existed, I think, except in the Middle Ages. And the newspapers today are basically just the voice of power, the voice of the government, the voice of the elite. And I think we should really understand that the people of the world have to take their own destiny in their own hands. They cannot rely on the mass media. They cannot rely on political parties. They cannot rely on the academics, because the academics have been also participating in the cover-up.
Well, that's right. And you know, we're talking about this Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was the main source that the 9/11 committee used to try to sell their story of what happened. All the footnotes lead back to him, and yet nobody ever saw him. Nobody on the commission ever saw him. They just took the word from, apparently, the CIA or the Bush administration about what he said. It's an outrage. It's unbelievable, but, hey, we're living it. Well, hey, thank you, Elias Davidson. It's been a pleasure talking with you, as always. I really admire your work, and I urge you to just, you know, keep on keeping on. We need you.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, take care.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, Elias Davidson, he's on the web at JUSPODENS.org. And I'm Kevin Barrett on the web at BarrettForCongress.us. I'll be back tomorrow, same time, same channel. See you then.